I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, our conversation with author Naomi Klein. She says the use of private contractors in Iraq is part of something bigger she calls disaster capitalism. But first, the family of a Massachusetts National Guard member who died in Afghanistan last week is questioning the circumstances of her death. The Army says Kira Durkin was found with a single bullet in her head, lying near a church she attended on the secure Bagram Air Base. Michael Levinson is covering the story for the Boston Globe. Michael, in early reports, family members said that Kira Durkin told them that she saw something in Afghanistan that might put her in danger. What are you hearing now?
When she came home recently, she had expressed to her family some concern about her safety there and asked them to please investigate her death if she were to die while she was deployed. Her family has not articulated what these concerns were, and that's sort of the central mystery. Why would she ask, you know, if I die, please investigate my death? That's obviously a troublesome statement, and at the time her family said it might have been a joke and they'd never thought much of it, but now, of course, that she's ended up dead in Bagram Airfield, that statement's coming back to the family very seriously.
Her family also told one of our reporters that she felt the base wasn't safe, that she had to wear body armor just to go to the ladies' room. Do we know what kind of work she did?
She's a member of the finance unit, and so basically she worked in a payroll department. She would have had contact with many of the soldiers on the base there handling their pay.
What has her family said about the fact that she is openly gay and their concerns that, you know, maybe that had something to do with her story?
They said she had been openly gay for a while in her own private life, but never spoke about that publicly in the military. Now they're speaking out about it because some members of the family are concerned that perhaps she might have been targeted by someone with anti-gay feelings in her unit. They don't have any direct evidence, I believe, of that, but as they're casting about for answers, some of them are wondering whether her sexuality might have played a role.
Well, we know that several local legislators have gotten involved in the story. Who are they and what are they asking of the military?
Senators Ted Kennedy and John Kerry and Congressman Bill Delahunt have all spoken with Defense Department officials and asked them to make sure that this death is thoroughly investigated. The Defense Department is investigating, but I think this is a way of at least letting the Pentagon know that there's some political pressure here.
What are some of the things the family is asking through these senators that the Army do?
The family would like there to be an independent autopsy done to conclusively identify what caused her death. That's one thing that's concerning them. And obviously, at bottom, just to find out how she could end up dead on a secure American airfield in Afghanistan.
We understand that the family's been told that they'd need to pay for an independent autopsy if that were to happen. Can you put this in larger context for us, Michael? Surely thousands of soldiers at Bagram base, how often are there any incidents like this? I mean, this is a soldier who shows up in civilian clothing near her church with a bullet in her head.
Certainly this is a very small minority of deaths. This is something that, at least right now, the Defense Department is classifying as a non-combat related incident. And these make up a very tiny minority of the deaths that happen in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's one reason why it's being investigated by the Army.
Just a final note, she comes from a very large family. She seemed to be very beloved.
She is the eighth of nine children from a very close-knit family. She was born in Ireland, came to Massachusetts at age nine. Obviously, her family is devastated, and it's actually garnering a lot of attention in Ireland as well, where she has relatives, and her family in Ireland has asked their Department of Foreign Affairs to look into this incident as well, so it's touched her family in two countries.
Michael Levinson, reporter for the Boston Globe, covering the death in Afghanistan of a Massachusetts National Guard member. Kira Durkin was found dead on the Bagram Air Base last week. Michael, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Today in Congress, the House is debating a bill that backers say will provide oversight of private security firms in Iraq, making all of them subject to prosecution by U.S. courts, closing the loophole that leaves State Department contractors immune to prosecution. The Senate passed a similar bill on Monday. University of Connecticut law professor Laura Dickinson, whom we spoke with yesterday, thinks the proposal would make the situation better because it would require the FBI to put together investigative teams on the ground in Iraq. Jeremy Scahill, author of Blackwater, says the bill can't be enforced. What American prosecutor is going to go to Iraq to interview Iraqi witnesses, for instance? But author Naomi Klein says there's a bigger problem. She says contractors are part of the new disaster capitalism, a plan to replace government jobs, fighting wars, building highways, or responding to catastrophes, with private industry. Naomi's book is titled The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. She joins us. Naomi, why'd you write this?
The point of this is to provide a challenge to the official story that these radical corporate policies have swept the world, whether in Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union, or Thatcher's Britain, or China, or Iraq, that this has been a peaceful enterprise. I think that this is the story that's so often told. We hear from George Bush that free people and free markets go hand in hand around the world. And what I'm doing with the book was show the interrelationship between crisis, shocks, disasters, and the advancement of an ideology that is actually very radical and is not supported by the majority of the people on this planet.
If disaster capitalism is happening, what in your mind is it replacing?
What it is replacing is the kind of market economy that dominated from the period after the Great Depression through the 60s, which was known as a mixed economy or a Keynesian economy, or in my country, in Canada, as social democracy. Part capitalist and also has elements, really, of socialism. I mean, you know, in my country, we have a public health care system. So this phase of disaster capitalism is really about the war against the welfare state.
Well, let's give you a chance to make your case. Let's talk about war spending first. Blackwater USA, under the spotlight now because of the recent shooting in Baghdad, Iraqis saying Blackwater security guards shot innocent civilians. Several investigations ongoing. Blackwater has built an army of 20,000 people that it's hired, a $50 million military base in North Carolina. This was part of the Pentagon plan under Donald Rumsfeld to contract out jobs and streamline the military.
In the book, I quote Mitch Daniels, who is Bush's former budget director, saying that the job of government is not to provide services, but to make sure that services are provided. So really what it is it's a vision of a hollow state. So it goes beyond what we tend to think of as privatization, you know, privatizing water, privatizing electricity, privatizing roads, sort of selling off the limbs of the state. And it enters the very core of what we think of as a core state function, like providing security, like police, like firefighting, like disaster response. And really what has emerged under Bush is this strategy of radically outsourcing these core functions.
Well, as you know, there are people saying, well, why is that a problem if it saves us money in Iraq? You say why you think it's a problem. First of all, that this is taxpayer money that's given to private companies like Halliburton or Blackwater USA.
This all happens in the fog of war. It's a kind of a corporate mission creep. And this is the thesis of the shock doctrine, is that then this shadow economy emerges where you have Blackwater with 20,000 soldiers at the ready. You have companies like Bechtel with, you know, very, very, you know, current equipment. And this has all been financed with public money, but the public doesn't own these assets. So what I'm worried about, and I think what we're seeing an increasing discussion of, is as the federal contracts start to dry up, then these companies can start to sell back the services at a price. And then, you know, you end up with a situation where, you know, a company like Blackwater can market its services in a disaster zone, but only the people who can afford security get it. This radical privatization agenda leaps forward under cover of crisis, under cover of shock, precisely because it's in those moments when public debate is very, very difficult. We are finding out that the Abu Ghraib scandal, where those photographs were leaked and we were horrified to see these images of abuse. But at the same time, through that scandal, we found out that a company like Khaki was engaging in military interrogation. And what does it mean when a private company is engaged in interrogation? There's the profit motive. And if there's the profit motive, then don't they have an added incentive to try to get whatever information will make the people paying their contracts, paying their bills, happy? But for me, the larger issue is that none of this was ever debated. I mean, there was never a public debate. You weren't sick the day that everyone decided it would be a good idea to have private companies engaged in prison interrogation or providing such essential security functions as Blackwater is doing in Iraq.
Let's talk about the domestic situation. You consider the recent news, for instance, the Minneapolis bridge collapse. A Wall Street Journal editorial afterwards said, get private investors to rebuild roads and bridges after the subway flooded in New York. Somebody suggested sell the subway to a private concern, they'll run it better. A lot of Americans feel that their local governments in particular have failed them. What is the problem with getting, a private company to, let's say, run the subway, build the bridges? What is your concern?
Well, you know, their local governments have failed them. But what I'm arguing in the book is that, you know, we tend to talk about this as if it's all been a series of mistakes. You know, it's just the incompetence or the greed of a local politician. What I'm arguing is that this steady decay of the public sphere is the result of a 25-year war against the public sphere, against so-called big government and the welfare state. So, you know, it erodes, and then it becomes indefensible, right? I mean, the subways don't work, and the bridges are collapsing, and of course you're ready for any change, any solution. But the problem with privatizing the bridges and the roads and the subways is that, of course, the business model changes, and it's no longer based on a principle of universal access, that this is what it means to be shared members of a society, that we all have access to certain essential services, and you start charging higher and higher tolls and fares. So you have, once again, you have this kind of radical two-tiering of society.
There was one example that you give that jumped out and stayed with me. It's this idea of privatized disaster response. You say it's now a hot industry in the South, a company calling itself HelpJet. Its promise is to turn a hurricane evacuation into a jet-setter vacation. They will come in and pick you up and take you away. What does that story tell you?
Well, like I said, you know, I feel like these disasters are giving us glimpses of the future, and we will get there if we're not careful. And HelpJet really stuck out for me as well. This is a company that was launched a year after Hurricane Katrina, and they're catering to the people who can afford to buy salvation and want more than salvation. They want luxury salvation. So they'll warn you when the hurricane is coming. They'll pick you up at your house and take you to a private terminal and put you on a charter plane and make your reservation at a 5-star golf resort or at Disney World. You know, they say, you know, escape the hassles and the lines and turn your hurricane into a luxury vacation. You know, another example is the New Orleans school system. 3 months after the levees broke, Milton Friedman, the guru of this extreme version of capitalism, this fundamental version of capitalism, wrote an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal, and he said, the parents and the teachers, the residents of New Orleans are spread across the country. The city lies in ruins. This is a tragedy. It's also an opportunity. It's an opportunity to remake New Orleans' school system. And that's exactly what's happened. You know, after the disaster, with the parents and the teachers unable to participate in this process precisely because they had been hit by this disaster, a lot of right-wing ideologues moved into the city and have turned New Orleans into the country's leading laboratory for charter schools.
Well, that's Naomi Klein. She's author of The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. And in the book, she quotes economist Milton Friedman further. Friedman has said, only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change. In other words, crisis is an opportunity for political or economic change. Well, when we come back, we'll hear what Naomi's critics have to say. And they do speak about those charter schools she just mentioned. If those charter schools can do a better job than public ones, they ask, why shouldn't parents be able to send their kids there? Don't forget, later in the program, Garrison Keillor will be here. We'll all be back after the news here and now. We're back with more from Naomi Klein, author of The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, making her case that corporations are taking advantage of disasters to move in and take over key government roles. Naomi, as you know, your theory's been criticized. You recently got into a heated debate with former Fed Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan on the Amy Goodman show Democracy Now! He basically accused you of being against a capitalist system. Ted Redburn of the New York Times writes that you are most blind to the necessary role of entrepreneurial capitalism. The National Post, a Toronto newspaper, ran excerpts from your book, but also a critique from columnist Terrence Corcoran, who said just 4 pages into The Shock Doctrine and already the wheels are flying off Naomi Klein's big new ideological busload of leftist fantasy. So let's start with him. He says your criticism of charter schools goes too far. What do you say to parents who want to send their kids to charter schools because they say public schools have failed them?
if it were parents that were driving this process, and if it were teachers that were driving this process, then I would have absolutely no problem with it, because I think that the school system is far too centralized. And anything that does decentralize it while keeping it accessible, I would be fully in favor of. My problem with what's happened in New Orleans is its anti-democratic nature. The thesis of the book is the challenge to the official story that this ideology has advanced hand in hand in tandem with freedom and democracy. If you can only advance your ideas in the aftermath of a cataclysmic event, I would say something is wrong with your ideas. I think that when ideas are good, they should be able to be tested in a democracy. And it's harder because life is messy and people disagree with you. But that's what it means to live in a democracy. The teachers' union was broken while the teachers were out of the city. Their contract was shredded. This was an extraordinarily anti-democratic process and also deeply unfair because, you know, more than $100 billion of public money was liberated in the name of reconstructing New Orleans. And I think that the residents of that city had a right to be part of deciding how that money was spent, and that it was a terrible stolen opportunity from them after they had suffered so much. But, you know, I want to respond to this claim that I'm against, entrepreneurial capitalism, because this campaign for this fundamentalist vision of a world that has no role for the state except to enforce contracts and to police borders is a very radical vision. It's a fundamentalist vision that has really been a rebellion against a mixed economy, which absolutely had elements of entrepreneurial capitalism in it and innovation in it. But it was regulated and it was limited, and there were spaces that were kept away from that entrepreneurial impulse precisely because they were considered too important. And so really when I debated Alan Greenspan, I was talking, and I said this very clearly to him, I was talking about not communism versus capitalism, which I think is really a straw man, but a mixed economy versus this fundamentalist vision of the world, which sees no role for the public.
You say that this disaster capitalism has been felt so much around the world that actually people, when disaster strikes, come up with conspiracy theories. They think that somebody deliberately caused the devastation so that they could profit from it. You say that's not happening, but what is?
You know, I think part of the reason why these conspiracy theories are so prevalent is because people see how quickly the disaster capitalism complex leaps into action. You know, you're in New Orleans and, you know, within days, Blackwater has shown up and they're providing private security, and Halliburton and Bechtel and Fluor and the whole, it's as if the green zone in Iraq has lifted up and landed on the Gulf Coast. And there's just this scramble to profit. And then there's also the policy opportunism. For instance, I start the book quoting a Republican congressman saying, "We couldn't clean out the housing projects, but God did." And there was a meeting at the Heritage Foundation 2 weeks after the levees broke, where they came up with 32 free market solutions, and it included everything from turning the Gulf Coast into a tax-free free enterprise zone to drilling in the National Arctic Wildlife Reserve. So people see the opportunism and they conclude, well, they must have caused the disaster so that they can exploit it. And what I'm arguing is it's not that they're causing the disasters, it's that what I'm describing as the shock doctrine, this philosophy of power, that it is only after a crisis that you can push through this radical ideology, is so deeply understood at the height of policymaking that the ideas are instantly ready as soon as the crisis hits. Some people stockpile canned goods and water in preparation for a disaster, but I think the Heritage Foundation and the American Enterprise Institute stockpile radical ideological plans.
Naomi Klein, if you are wrong, you are Chicken Little. If you are right, do you think there's any way to put this back in the box? Is there any way to reverse this?
You know, I think that there is. And one of the things that I do in the book is I look at these key junctures where this ideology leapt forward. Going back 35 years, Latin America in the 70s and Poland in 1989, South Africa in 1994, these key junctures where economic shock therapy was imposed on a country. And one of the truisms of our time is the idea that there is no alternative, that these ideas have triumphed precisely because all other ideas revealed themselves to be failed, to be broken, to be wanting. And we often hear the only thing worse than capitalism is the alternative. But when I take another look at these key junctures and show how important crisis and disaster was in advancing the ideology, is I also show that there were real alternatives that were proposed and that people voted for at all of these key junctures. And I think that when we look at those alternatives, whether it was solidarity in Poland's economic program or the African National Congress in South Africa, their plans to really redistribute the wealth of the country, when we look at this, then we see that it's not that there was no alternative. It's that those alternatives never had a chance. And I think that when we do that, then there's a chance to have more confidence in the alternatives to this economic model. I think it is possible to reverse this trend, but only if the people who believe in a different world, who don't believe that, when a crisis hits, the wealthy should be able to escape in luxury jets and the poor should be left to drown, only if those people have the confidence in their vision of a more equitable world when push comes to shove and fight for their vision instead of just allowing the disaster capitalists to advance theirs.
Naomi Klein, her new book is The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. Naomi, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, looking ahead, tomorrow on Here and Now, two loving brothers, one an openly gay Episcopalian priest, one a bishop who's broken with the church over gay rights. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, what happened to Carol Ann Gottbaum, the 45-year-old mother of three who died in police custody in Phoenix? We'll have that story as well. Back after the news, Here and Now. Today we want to check in on the death of Carol Ann Gottbaum, the 45-year-old mother of three who died in police custody at the Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport on Friday night. She was on her way to an alcohol rehab facility and, according to witnesses, became frantic, pacing and screaming when gate crews said she was too late to board a Tucson-bound flight. Two Phoenix police officers arrested her for disorderly conduct. They say they handcuffed Gottbaum, left her shackled and unattended in a room at the airport precinct, and then found her unresponsive minutes later. A spokesperson said police suspect that Gottbaum strangled herself trying to escape her restraints. We want to say up front, this story has hit home. Carol Ann Gottbaum is the sister-in-law of Here Now contributor Rachel Gottbaum. Carol Ann is also the daughter-in-law of New York public advocate Betsy Gottbaum. Jonna Berry is covering the story for the Arizona Republic. Jonna, an autopsy was performed by the Maricopa County Medical Examiner's Office yesterday. What does it show?
Right now, the results of that are inconclusive. There was an autopsy, but it could be weeks, up to 90 days before laboratory work and a detailed analysis is done at this point. So no conclusions have been drawn about her death at this point.
Well, let's go back to that Friday night. Phoenix police say they locked Gottbaum handcuffed in this room at the airport. Can you, first of all, describe what you've heard of how she was locked in the handcuffs?
The way that the police have described it is that she was restrained with a shackle that had two handcuffs with 16 inches of chain between both handcuffs, and one of those cuffs was then chained to a bench. The whole contraption was about 24 inches, 2 feet long.
Yeah. They say 5 to 10 minutes later, they found her with her handcuffs near her neck area. As you well know, there's been a lot of speculation as how one would do this, bring the handcuffs up over their head. Do you know of any other cases of self-strangulation in these circumstances? Have you researched that?
We have actually asked the police that question ourselves, but we have not gotten any kind of statistic from them about whether or not this is something that's prevalent, whether or not there's something that the city should be concerned about. I did talk to the city manager, and he is awaiting the report, and he said, obviously, if there is something that they need to look at with the restraints, they will.
Yeah. And what about police policy in these cases? If they leave someone alone, is there video surveillance?
Actually, the police have told me that by policy, they are not allowed to videotape people when they are in custody. So as far as I know, there is no videotape of what happened in that holding room. There is videotape, I understand, of what may have happened in the concourse. That was the boarding area where the incident began. And from what I understand, they will be reviewing that to see if that provides any clues for the investigation.
How are people in the Arizona area responding to this story? Are they sympathetic toward Caroline Gottbaum or to the police? What's been the response?
It's been a little bit of a mixed bag. A lot of people obviously could see themselves in a situation where maybe they become distraught over a flight. And so everyone has a lot of questions about, you know, what's the normal procedure? Is this something that I should be worried about? At the same time, a lot of people and our readers realize these are heightened times of security. And if someone is acting in what police perceive as an erratic manner, that there may be need for that person to go into custody. So it just depends on who you talk to.
Jonna Berry of the Arizona Republic. Jonna, thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
And we turn now to Michael Manning, the lawyer for the Gottbaum family. Michael, you hired pathologist Dr. Cyril Wecht, who investigated the deaths of John F. Kennedy and Elvis Presley. Very high-powered. You obviously suspect something.
Well, we do, and we wanted to ensure that the ME's office, who has a strong relationship with our local PD, did a thorough, honest, complete, and fair job, and that the relationship between those two did not infect the integrity of the ME's examination.
I'm sure they would say that, you know, they're professionals and they're able to do the exam without issues, but what are your questions?
Well, we want to know exactly how it could be that this woman would die in this little holding area and be asphyxiated with this chain. She clearly didn't kill herself, and we don't believe the police intentionally killed her, but something went horribly wrong in this entire process. And frankly, the real story here is, why was this 45-year-old, 120-pound mother of three treated the way she was treated? Why was she taken to the ground? They just tackled her, handcuffed her to behind her back, and then shackled her to a bench in a holding area with no video surveillance.
No one has come forward from the scene, witnesses, to say anything other than that Caroline Gottbaum was hysterical, that she seemed not all there. Post 9/11, is there a sense that somebody who might be a threat, who might be a danger to others, even if also to herself, needed to be quickly, you know, as you say, tackled and taken out of the area?
We take that as true, that she was disturbing the peace, that the police had to intervene. It's just the manner in which you intervene. And 9/11 or not, the law and the policies and procedures have been that you don't take a citizen who is merely a disturbance, maybe even intoxicated. You don't handcuff them behind the back. You don't leave that person alone, shackled to that bench without anybody to observe what's happening inside that room.
What's your response to what we just heard from our reporter in Phoenix, that the police say they're not allowed to videotape someone that they've detained?
Well, that's absolutely incorrect. They videotape in this county, in this city all the time, detainees. Mm-hmm. But if you don't have a videotape, you always have somebody there watching. And another matter that's going to be important in this case is, why didn't they get medical intervention there with Carol immediately? This was obviously not a criminal, obviously not a terrorist, and she even announced, look, I'm a sick mother, I just need help. Their own policies and procedures say someone like that must be allowed to have medical attention right away. That's the intervention that's supposed to occur.
Michael, you say you're someone who might have been intoxicated. She was on her way to rehab.
Right.
Is there a chance that her death could have been because she was drunk or medicated or on something that might have destabilized her?
We know when she landed in Phoenix, she was confident, she was utterly sober and excited about getting help. She called her husband and she said, Noah, I'm going to do this for the kids, I'm going to do this for us, I'm going to do this for our marriage. And you know it's very easy to knock an alcoholic off the balance beam of that commitment very easily. And that's what happened here. After she got back from lunch, she approached the gate agent. She said, here's my boarding pass. The gate agent said, I'm sorry, we've got no room for you. Your seat's been given away. You're late. And that's when her emotional meltdown started, because she was so committed to getting to Tucson and getting help. She said, I've got to get on that plane. please find a seat for me. And she became very angry and created a disturbance. There's no doubt about it. Now, did she drink over lunch? I don't know that yet. I believe we'll find out that she probably did. But if she did drink, she was committed. She wanted to get to Tucson. And when she was denied boarding, rather than decide, well, I'm going to go back to the bar, or I'm going to go to New York, back to New York and drink, she said, no, I've got to get there. And that's when it started.
Michael, thank you very much for speaking with us.
All right. Have a good day.
Michael Manning, the lawyer for Carol Ann Gottbaum's family. She died while in police custody at the Phoenix airport on Friday. Well, before we go today, Garrison Keillor, he'll tell us how he spins that Lake Wobegon tale every week without a safety net. You're listening to Here and Now. Scientists in the Netherlands are saying plants talk to each other using an underground tube system that connects them. That, for instance, when a caterpillar is munching away on a leaf, the plants circle the wagons, metaphorically, of course, and fight back. Joining us on the line is Professor Josef Schurtfer, who researches experimental plant ecology at Radboud University in the Netherlands. Professor, welcome.
Hello.
Well, this is quite something. You and your colleagues actually first put forth the idea of plant communication in 2004. What's new in your latest research?
Well, the new thing, I guess, is that we haven't realized that plants have a sort of intranet system. They have physical connections between each other. I mean, not all plants, but many plants have such connections. And they can use these connections to exchange information. They can exchange signals, for example, when they are attacked by caterpillars.
I've rooted around in the dirt quite a bit as a gardener, and you know when you transplant plants, there's all these root systems. This connection that you're talking about, is that just these root systems that interlock?
Yes and no. It's not the roots, actually, but it's shoots, which can grow underground or above ground. And these shoots, they grow horizontally. So if you have strawberries in your garden, or clovers, just look at the ground, and you will see a whole network of tubes or cables connecting, literally, individual plants. So it's not the roots themselves, but it's stems, either below ground or above ground.
Huh. And what else goes along these roots? I mean, you know, how does this communication happen?
Well, the caterpillar gets on a plant and eats a piece of the plant. The plant recognizes that a herbivore is damaging it. So if you cut off a leaf with a pair of scissors, for example, nothing happens because the plant can sense specific compounds in the saliva of caterpillars and respond very specifically to those.
Hmm.
Then the damaged leaf presumably produces this unknown signal. We don't know what the signal is, and we can't see it, but we can see the effect it has on the receiving members of the network.
What do they do?
Once the signal arrives, they produce more toxic chemicals in their tissues, and we also found that they get harder. So all these changes are intended to deter caterpillars and to make them walk off, let's say, to other plants.
You say these defending plants actually make their leaves less palatable to the caterpillars and harder to bite.
Yeah, exactly.
It's amazing. Now, well, you know, this is a slippery slope, especially for vegetarians. What are you saying? Are you saying that plants, you know, is there some emotional content behind this, or is this just a sheerly chemical reaction?
That's difficult to know, of course, but what we think is that this communication is communication for survival. So I don't think it's emotional communication, but it's communication really for survival.
You would call this talking?
Well, you could say so. Of course, we can't hear them talk. We don't have senses for this type of communication. So In a general way, I think, yes, plants are talking to each other, but we can't hear them.
How far do you think that this can go? I mean, who else do plants, do you think, talk to birds?
Actually, we know that some plants do talk to birds, and many plants actually talk to insects, which are the enemies of their own enemies. We haven't studied that for our system yet, but it's known that plants, after being attacked, for example, by insect caterpillars, they release volatiles, gaseous substances, to the air, which attract the enemies of the caterpillars.
Ah. Come get the caterpillar.
Yes, exactly.
Professor Josef Storfer, an assistant professor researching experimental plant ecology at Radboud University in the Netherlands. Professor, thank you so much. Fascinating.
You're welcome.
Now I have to worry about hurting a plant's feeling. When we come back, Garrison Keillor, after a break, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
It's been a quiet week in Lake Wobegon. It's a beautiful, warm week this last week. And this gorgeous smell in the air.
Every Saturday on Public Radio's A Prairie Home Companion, Garrison Keillor steps up to the mic without a script and performs a daredevil routine, telling from memory the latest news from Lake Wobegon, the Minnesota town where all the women are strong, all the men are good-looking, etc., where Pastor Inkvist shepherds the faithful Lutherans, and where, as we learn at the beginning of Keillor's new novel, a member of the pastor's church, Evelyn Peterson, has just died.
She could be exalted by a good ball game, or by the dawn, a cup of fresh coffee, the open door, the pink and silver and pale blue sky, the inhalation of lake and grass. And she wept to hear the contralto sing, for he shall feed his flock like a shepherd. She could marvel at the ingenuity of screws, or apply herself to polishing up her Spanish.
That's Garrison Keillor reading from his best-selling novel, Pontoon. Evelyn has asked that her ashes be dropped into Lake Wobegon in a bowling ball, and a cast of characters, including a naked parasailing grandchild, a group of visiting renegade Danish Lutheran pastors, and a pontoon, all figure into her finale. We don't want to give away too much, but when Garrison was visiting Boston, we asked him to tell us more about Evelyn.
Evelyn is a stalwart of Lake Wobegon. She is a Lutheran lady. She is the one who arranges the supper after your funeral. Well, not your funeral, but, you know, my funeral. And you need a wedding supper, she'll do it. She's one of the quilters. She's a faithful lady. But underneath her stalwartness and her Lutheranness, there are secrets, and everybody can tell it, but nobody wants to pry. These don't really come out until she dies.
Well, and this idea that the still waters run deep, and in her case, not very still waters, you know, she's quite a character. You know, people, it's revealed people have secrets, whether it's a lover in another town or a little extra something in their cocoa. All of these secrets are revealed, and it seems to us that that's sort of the trick of Lake Wobegon that always begins a sort of placid story, placid lake, and then people have these other extraordinary lives.
Well, people usually leave town if they're going to have an extraordinary life, and so we're a great exporter of people. You need to go away someplace where you can sow your wild oats, and you can meet all kinds of odd people and hang out with them and not hear about it the next day from your relatives.
Like Debbie, who goes off to California, ends up falling in with a woman who has a company that does what?
She does veterinary aromatherapy. She treats cats with, hyacinths and narcissus and eucalyptus.
And she dies, that woman. How does she die?
Eucalyptus has a powerful effect on her. She sort of loses her sense of orientation. She swerves to avoid a deer on the coastal highway up in Marin County on Highway 1. And she plunges to her death on the rocks.
Characters in Lake Wobegon, they die in odd ways. They bring a smile to your face. I don't think you mean for us to laugh at death. What? And you're looking at me like, and your question is, what is that aspect of the storytelling?
I think that the point of it is cheerfulness. I believe in cheerfulness as the bedrock of humor. Cheerfulness does not mean happiness. It doesn't mean, euphoria may not even mean satisfaction. It just means to have a cheerful demeanor, which is a good rule for people as they get on in life. Gloom and self-absorption are for teenagers. Once you pass a certain point, and I passed it a long time ago, you're supposed to be cheerful.
Garrison Keillor, do you think you are cheerful?
Yes, I do. I do. I have to work hard at it because I come from dark people. I come from people who were always expecting disaster. But yes, I think I am.
I've gotten you way off on a tangent. Let's get back to Evelyn. You mentioned Evelyn's Lutheranness. What is that?
Lutheranness is a kind of self-effacement, to be last, to put yourself at the service of other people is true Lutheranism, to be a part of the group, to be almost invisible, to be the person who after a wonderful evening, people look around and they realize, well, there you are. You've been waiting on table. You've brought them their food, which you made, which was wonderful, and you provided all of this. That's the Lutheran ideal. When Thoreau talked about people marching to their own drummer, that is not Lutheran. That is anti-Lutheran. We believe in keeping step, you know. If you don't have a good sense of time, learn it. Just watch the others. It'll come to you.
What do Lutheran ministers say to you about the way you speak of the faith and, you know, the quilters and Pastor Ingfest? And
Lutheran pastors are very, very polite. And sometimes, I mean, they claim to get ideas for sermons from the News from Lake Wobegon, or they claim to have quoted me or used something from the show. I can't quite imagine that they actually do, but they're sweet men, and they know that I love them, so I'm free to make fun of them a little bit.
How long will you be telling us stories of Lake Wobegon? Is there a time when you're going to... Will there be a last chapter from Lake Wobegon, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I think that it just... I think it just goes on and on. At some point, I mean, I won't do it anymore, but the people will drift off into space.
We know that you deliver these stories pretty much without a script, so these complicated storylines that you tie together at the end are all just coming out of your head. Are you thinking about them all the time? Are you walking around with this entire town in your head?
No. It's really not a... No great mystery, no great feat, really. I simply discovered a long time ago that if you write something at the last minute, you will remember it. Mm-hmm. There's no need to memorize. You will remember it. You may not get it exactly in the order that you thought, and you will forget some stuff, mostly the forgettable stuff. But if you sit down, as I do on a Saturday morning, and you just write notes to yourself, they start to take shape on the page, but you don't try to arrange this as a script. When you come to do the broadcast, you in your mind, you'll have a beginning and a middle and an end, or at least you'll have a beginning and an end, and the middle will take care of itself, and it will come back to you. There's no big mystery about it.
Garrison Keillor. Now, how can we tell that you're cheerful?
I have a cheerful heart. I mean, I don't have a cheerful demeanor. I was brought up by serious people who expected the world to end at any moment. They expected the millennium, the second coming. And they believed that God had very high standards and that, you know, a lot of people were not going to pass the test who maybe thought they were. So, I mean, it makes its mark on a person growing up, but I have a cheerful heart.
Garrison Keillor, his new novel is Pontoon. We leave you with his thoughts from the book on Lutherans.
And so, we are not a lighthearted Mediterranean people. We're Lutherans, even the Catholics are. And though one doesn't like to generalize about Lutherans, one thing is most certainly true of every last one of them. The low point of their year is summer vacation. they are suspicious of pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.